the big stack of papers should be default, and there should be something in there, because a lot of people, if they got that, would assume at that point that web access was the only option they had, because this doesn't specify that they're told anything else.
The big stack of paper should be the default.
Right.
Council.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, at least the way I'm reading it, but the way you read it is, and make that legislative history, not the way I read it, but unless a person entitled to notice requests the paper copies provided at the time of the mailing, the mailing, I read, refers back to the sentence before that, by regular mail or by electronic mail. So my assumption would be that if the person has requested by regular, they received notice by regular mail, that they should be getting copies of the regulations by regular mail. Is that correct, Mr. Martin?
Madam Chair, Mr. Taylor, that is correct. If they are requesting copies of the notice by regular mail, that would not change.
Okay, so, this whole list of folks that are currently receiving the big stack of mail, does this change anything that's currently happening with them? Do they still get the big stack, or do they get the little notice?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, that could change from the standpoint they would need to request that they continue to receive paper copies.
And that's the way I read it, that it does change what they're getting unless they do something else to continue getting what they're getting.
Yeah, the citizen has to initiate to get the big stack if this was to pass. Is that?
Go ahead. Madam Chairman, maybe one way, maybe I can suggest a way out of this conundrum, and that is that when our department puts together its instructions to agencies in our administrative law manual about how to do rulemaking, one of the things we currently have in there are some tips about how to update notices and how to get information out to people and how to give people the opportunity to choose to get electronic mail or snail mail. And one of the things we could do would be to update that information so that agencies would know that they need to provide people, if they send out a little postcard notice, they need to provide a specific mechanism whereby people can make the choice to go back to solid paper, if that makes any sense to you. In other words, we'd be preserving the flexibility for agencies to still send out what I'm thinking of as the postcard notice of the website address, but have the postcard notice contain instructions for the for those citizens who wanted to exercise the right that they have under this provision to go back to paper. Does that make sense? Now, obviously, what I'm suggesting wouldn't be something that would be in the bill. It would be something that we'd have to do in our education of agencies, and the committee may not be comfortable with that sort of somewhat more loose way of handling this.
Well, I think what I'm hearing is concerns is that people who think that they're on the list and they're going to get the regulations, that suddenly they don't get the regulations anymore. They get directed to a website.
Right.
And whether the people should, I mean, I would be standing in line to request the website as opposed to having these big stacks of paper. But Senator Beyer and I think Senator Cruz are saying that the default should be the way it is now, and then people should have the option to choose. It would be great if we could find some way, very, very user-friendly way that people are likely to respond to get them, to encourage people to go web-based. I mean, it's really a good thing to reduce the paper. So maybe what we should do is try to think of ways that we can do that.
I'm sure it'd be relatively simple and not all that expensive to those who are getting the big stack currently. And personally, I prefer the big stack because it's easier to read than something on an email, you know, is what's added, what's deleted. I mean, it's easier for me to, and I can tear it apart and do all that stuff. It's just easier. And I guess I, you know, for those who would like to get this on a website, rather than they should be given the option you know, just a notice goes out, say, we have a new way you can get this. Here's another choice, rather than defaulting them to a web-based system.
And then the people who have already expressed a preference for email, they would continue to get it. They would not get the big stack.
Yeah, that has nothing to do with this.
So this is only, this would only affect the people by snail mail. So you could, you know, one option to this, which wouldn't obviously probably get the same kind of results, but one option would be to contact people and give them the option to see how many pick it.
Well, yeah, Madam Chair, and I personally am not comfortable allowing the Department of Justice to do this by rule.
we will take up the responsibility
but,
here.
But I think the main thing is just turn it around so that the agency has to do what they're doing today unless the citizen requests something different.
And it would be, I'd like to go a step further and give, if they need it, the authority for the agency to reach out to people. They probably don't need it in legislation to give people the option, but make it very clear that if people do choose to get it on a website, that they can continue serving that person
Absolutely.
By website
Absolutely.
Until that person takes an affirmative
yeah.
step
well,
the other
well,
way.
And Madam Chair, that we need not to do a special mailing next time they send out notice of rulemaking. They could send it as an addendum to that, saying we have a new service. Would you like to opt into it? So
the question is, if we were going to do that, if we would need legislative authority. Counsel?
Madam Chair, so I'm getting the sense of the committee is that if someone is receiving notice electronically now of the notice of proposed rulemaking, there'd be a presumption that they would receive notice of the rules themselves electronically. And if they were receiving it via regular mail, there'd be a presumption that they would be receive copies of the proposed rules via regular mail. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
but with a potential option of receiving it on the website.
Okay. So it would really be in the agency's interest to find ways to reach out to people that they're likely to respond to, that they wouldn't just recycle the option postcard. Because some people, it's hard to believe, but some people still don't have computers and internet and access to the website. So why don't we...
And Madam Chair, there's lots of areas in my district where the people can't get high-speed internet.
Right.
So, you know, you want to go download or look at a web page at a 14.4 modem speed. It takes a while.
Yeah. Okay, well, why don't we, we'll take this under advisement and try to see if we even need, it would seem to me you already have the authority to give people the option to get it, but if you need more authority, we could use this as a vehicle to do that. So we'll close, any other comments? Close the hearing on House Bill 2121. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2130.
Thank you, Madam Council. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2130 comes to you at the request of Attorney General Hardy Morris of the Department of Justice. Allows the Attorney General to distribute more than 50% of the funds in the criminal injuries compensation account for victims assistance programs operated by the district attorneys.
Okay. So that is it. Cynthia Stinson. Welcome.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Cynthia Stinson, the director of the Department of Justice Crime Victims Assistance Section, and I'm here today to speak in favor of House Bill 2130. If I may, I'd like to give you a brief description of the Crime Victims Assistance Section, which will put this bill in context, and that's on the blue sheet there in front of you. Our section has two main programs. The first is the Crime Victims Compensation Program, which provides reimbursement to individual victims of person crimes for crime-related injuries that are not covered by any prior research, such as insurance or Oregon Health Plan. The benefits that victims can receive include medical counseling, loss of earnings, loss of support, and funeral benefits. This program also includes payments for child medical assessments and payments from the Sexual Assault Victims Emergency Response, or SAVE Fund, which provides payment for forensic medical exams for victims of sexual assault. This program is funded by the State Criminal Fines and Assessment Account, which is fines and fees from offenders, and also some punitive damages and federal matching funds. The other main program in our section is the Victim Assistance Program, which is made up of six grant programs administering state and federal funds to government and nonprofit agencies serving victims of crime. Those federal grants include the Federal Victim of Crime Act and the Federal Violence Against Women Act funds, and then state funds that are distributed include funds to the district and city attorney victim assistance programs from the Criminal Fines and Assessment Account, which funds all 36 programs in all 36 counties, and then five city programs. It also includes the Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Account funds that comes from also from that CFAA account. And that funds multidisciplinary teams in all 36 counties, and also includes funding to nine child abuse assessment centers and three regional centers. And then the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Service Fund comes out of general fund money and funds over 50 agencies serving victims of domestic violence and sexual assault all over the state. We have a small discretionary grant program which allows the state to make grants to victim service agencies if enough money comes in through punitive damages to cover our crime victims compensation program. And finally, we have our new address confidentiality program that's also in the victim assistance area. That provides a mail forwarding service for victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking who need an alternate address for safety reasons. So with that overview, I'd like to then tell you what House Bill 2130 does. The money that comes from the criminal fines and assessment account to the crime victims assistance section into our criminal injuries compensation account for this kind of line item goes to two of those programs. One program that's in the compensation goes to fund compensation, and then one is a grant program. So in current statute, we are directed to give at least, or excuse me, up to 50% of the money that comes into our CIC account on that line item from the criminal fines and assessment account to the district and city attorney victim assistance program. So that's up to 50%. This bill would remove that 50% limit and allow us to provide more funds to the district and city attorney victim assistance programs if we have enough funds. So right now, any increase in those CFAA funds going to the criminal injuries compensation account has to be split at least, up to equally, I guess I should say. Our practice in the crime victims assistance section has been to send 50% and not less back to those DA programs. But the two programs, the compensation program and the programs at the county levels, have very different funding needs, as you may imagine, so they don't necessarily work in congruence. So we're hoping to lift that 50% limit so that if we are able, we can send more than 50% back to the county programs, the local level.
Okay, so you're the only person signed up on this. I assume the district attorneys have bought off on this and the city attorneys?
Yes, Chair Broderick, members of the committee, the ODAA is in full support of this bill.
Yeah, they get more money, I think they would.
But there's no more money on the table on this. It's just a difference in allocation. Is that correct?
Correct, Chair Burdick. We do have in our policy package this session an increase that's in the governor's recommended budget of $2 million that would go to this line item. So under current law, we would be required to only distribute up to 50% of that to the district and city attorney programs. Mm-hmm. And if that requirement were lifted, we could, if we had enough money to cover our compensation program costs, send more back to them from that money that's coming from the GRB this session.
Can you tell me where the other half goes again?
To our crime victims compensation program to pay for those benefits to individual victims of crime. So part of it stays with our program to pay those individual benefits, and then the other, right now half, is routed back to all 36 counties and 5 city programs.
And that's the piece that would get more than 50% if you had the money available.
Potentially, uh-huh.
But the crime victims, the individual victims, they have first call on the money?
Sure, Burdick. There's really not language that says they have first call, but it would. I don't think that the district and city attorney programs would really approve of us taking money from individual victims of crime in order to route it back to their programs. We try to be very conscientious about making sure that both are funded at a commensurate level.
And this wouldn't require you to give more than 50%. It would just allow you to.
Chair Burdick, that's correct.
Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer.
Yeah, it strikes me odd that I was curious to hear the testimony if you wanted to give more or less, because this bill clearly allows the full discretion to be at the department, you know, at the Attorney General's, you know, or their designee. So I'm just shocked that whoever's going to get less isn't here arguing against it.
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, it's our program. It would be our program itself that would get less, the Crime Victims Compensation Program. If we were to give more money to the district and city attorney programs, it would be our own Crime Victims Compensation Program that would get less money. May I explain a little further?
Yes, but that begs the question, and there's nothing in there that says that you aren't going to go the other way and all of a sudden start giving their program more.
Yeah, but that's already allowed.
That's true.
Yeah, it's up to 50%. So,
if I may, Chair Burdick, yes. Just a clarification. The genesis of this bill came from us constructing our policy package and asking for more funding in our policy package, and we realized that the amount that was requested in our budget package, that if that were passed and came back to us, we would not be able to pass on the amount that we were hoping to pass on to the district and city attorney programs. So we realized we needed to have a bill to fix that so that we could have more discretion to give more money to those programs.
The local level. Okay. Any other questions, comments from the committee? Thank you. Okay, we'll close the hearing on House Bill 2130. Senator Beyer, are you ready for a work session? We'll open a work session on House Bill 2130. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2130 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2130 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Would anybody like to carry this?
Sure, I will.
Senator Walker,
better put my city in here.
This fine bill here. Okay, now we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2141. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2141 is filed at the request of Attorney General Hardy Morris of the Department of Justice. Allows the Court of Appeals in juvenile dependency and juvenile delinquency cases and voluntary mental commitment judgments and involuntary commitment judgments of persons with developmental disabilities to summarily affirm the Circuit Court's decision that the Court of Appeals finds the appeal does not present a substantial question of law, establishes that an order of summary affirmance constitutes a decision upon the merits of the appeal.
Okay. Richard Wasserman. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Richard Wasserman. I'm the attorney in charge of the Civil and Administrative Appeals Unit within the Appellate Division of the Department of Justice. With the chair's permission, I'd like to call up to share the table Amy Miller from Juvenile Rights Project, since our offices have been talking about some possible amendments to the bill.
Please come on up, Amy. Welcome.
As as the committee can see from the written testimony, since 1995 there have been statutes similar to the amendments that are being proposed today calling for summary affirmance in various other contexts. Statutes include direct criminal appeals, post-conviction appeals, habeas corpus, and appeals from final orders of the parole board. The bill that's in front of the committee would extend the same authority to the Court of Appeals for three other categories of case, juvenile cases, which would include dependency and termination, as well as delinquency cases, and mental commitment appeals and mental disability appeals, which we hardly ever see, quite frankly. Summary affirmance operates under current law and would operate under this statute in very simply. The appellant would have an opportunity under this bill, as under current statutes, to submit an opening brief, and only at that time would a motion for summary affirmance or even summary affirmance on the court's own motion be permitted. The appellant would have an opportunity to respond, and then the Court of Appeals could decide whether or not the appeal presents any substantial question or instead should be summarily affirmed.
Okay, so this would basically expand the list of things that can
use this process. Simply expands summary affirmance into three areas. In essence, the current statutes, and we envision the new statute, the new bill, if passed, would provide a very simple, straightforward way to get rid of what are, in essence, frivolous appeals, appeals that are in nobody's interest to have in the system.
And but if they can show that there are substantial questions of law involved,
then the appeal would proceed to full briefing and oral argument and decision by the appellate court.
Yeah, that word substantial, is that the same word that applies to the other categories that
yes.
have this?
The new language in the amendment, Madam Chair, tracks very closely the language in the four existing statutes.
Okay. Any questions from the committee? Senator Beyer.
Well, I guess just put it in layman terms. What brought this forward? What problem are you trying to fix?
Well, we have, as I've said, statutes that have been working quite well since 1995 in four specific areas. They save our office considerable resources. They save the court considerable resources. And it was simply thought to be a good idea to expand that express authority for the court into areas in which the court doesn't have the express authority to do that.
So if I can follow up your question, what kind of impact do you think it will make on the habeas corpus appeals, which I assume are coming from the prison?
Well, habeas appeals are currently covered by the statute, and I don't have...
Oh, I see.
Yeah, habeas under ORS 34.712, Madam Chair, that statute has been in effect for quite some time, as have the statutes for criminal direct appeals and post-conviction. And
I apologize. I was reading
okay.
the wrong part of your testimony.
Right.
Here.
Madam Chair,
Senator,
if I can just follow up, I guess, have you seen a sudden increase in these three areas of what you're calling frivolous appeals? Is that why you're bringing it forward this time, or is there...
No, Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, this bill isn't triggered by any sudden increase in frivolous appeals in any particular area. It was simply seen And we've got four existing statutes that have worked well for a long time, and with the new legislative session, it was thought that this would be an appropriate opportunity to expand what's already a good thing into three other areas in which we see a lot of appeals, but not necessarily a high level of frivolous appeals by any means.
Hmm. Any other questions? Amy, why don't you give your piece here?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Amy Miller, and I'm a staff attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project. I want to first apologize in advance for not raising concerns with the Department of Justice when this bill was being considered by the House. It came up pretty quickly there, and our office is full of trial attorneys, very few appellate attorneys, so it took us some time to do the research to figure out how this could apply in juvenile cases. So I just wanted to let you know that. But we had a couple of concerns, and we're working with the Department of Justice on a couple of amendments just to ensure that the current scope of review on the facts, which is de novo review in juvenile cases, continues even if these amendments are made, and then also just to ensure that that these types of motions wouldn't slow down the appeals process in dependency and termination cases specifically, because those are of greater concern. So just wanted to make the committee aware of those concerns and that we are working together with the Department of Justice.
Okay. I wanted to go back to Senator Barr's question, and that is, how many of these frivolous cases in these three categories do you think you get? I mean, do you get a lot of them?
Probably, Madam Chair, only a handful a year. In the new categories of cases that would be covered, because of the very high volume in direct criminal appeals and habeas appeals, many of which are brought by pro ses and post-conviction cases where the same can be said, there is a significantly larger number of frivolous appeals that we see, and we use motions for summary affirmance with some regularity. I don't envision that we would file very many motions for summary affirmance under the cases that would be newly covered under this bill.
Okay.
Thank you.
So it wouldn't be any pro se.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. We'll move on to Lane Barlow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Lane Barlow. I'm with Oregon Men's Association. We're a loose coalition of concerned citizens that are they're pretty concerned about how the state at every level deals with its citizens, particularly in family law matters. And as a special interest is how the courts deal with people. We've lobbied in one form or another every session since 1995, and several of you have seen us before. Our main objection to this is that there's already a big problem with the Court of Appeals with AWOPs affirming without opinion. And I guess I'm one of those frivolous appeals because I'm pro se. Attached to our testimony, you see a letter that was sent to the high judges, including Judge Landau on the Court of Appeals in April of 2004. This addressed the issue of so-called frivolous appeals. Some people, including myself, we go to the appellate process because the lower courts aren't doing their jobs. We can go on and on about all kinds of complaints and specific cases. That's not our purpose here. Our concern is that you're going to take allow these three classes of cases to be included in summary affirmance. Being an experienced before this in the House Judiciary Committee, I know how some of this goes. We recommend a change that you'll see in the last paragraph of our testimony there. Just change it so that the court has to explain itself. We're concerned that it says substantial question of law without defining what substantial means. Across the board, all the way from traffic court cases and municipal courts, justice courts, all the way up to the Supreme Court, we've seen a serious lack of respect for the rule of law, and mainly that's because there's no way to hurt a judge. There's you take them before the Commission on Judicial Fitness, and that is dominated by bench and bar. There's no justice there. Rather than turn this as what Justice Gillette, Justice Gillette at the last session characterized people who complain about how the courts work as basically being sour grapes and a bunch of losers who just can't seem to go their way. It's way too easy for a court to brush aside somebody because they're not part of the club, because they don't have a member of the bar that's representing them. Sometimes that's from lack of funds. Deals with its citizens, particularly in family law matters. And as a special interest is how the courts deal with people. We've lobbied in one form or another every session since 1995, and several of you have seen us before. Our main objection to this is that there's already a big problem with the Court of Appeals with AWOPs affirming without opinion. And I guess I'm one of those frivolous appeals because I'm pro se. Attached to our testimony, you see a letter that was sent to the high judges, including Judge Landau in the Court of Appeals in April of 2004. This addressed the issue of so-called frivolous appeals. Some people, including myself, we go to the appellate process because the lower courts aren't doing their jobs. We can go on and on about all kinds of complaints and specific cases. That's not our purpose here. Our concern is that you're going to take allow these three classes of cases to be included in summary affirmance. Being an experience before this in the House Judiciary Committee, I know how some of this goes. We recommend a change that you'll see in the last paragraph of our testimony there. Just change it so that the court has to explain itself. We're concerned that it says substantial question of law without defining what substantial means. Across the board, all the way from traffic court cases and municipal courts, justice courts, all the way up to the Supreme Court, we've seen a serious lack of respect for the rule of law, and mainly that's because there's no way to hurt a judge. There's you take them before the Commission on Judicial Fitness, and that is dominated by bench and bar. There's no justice there. Rather than turn this as what Justice Gillette, Justice Gillette at the last session characterized people who complain about how the courts work as basically being sour grapes and a bunch of losers who just can't seem to go their way. It's way too easy for a court to brush aside somebody because they're not part of the club, because they don't have a member of the bar that's representing them. Sometimes that's from lack of funds. Sometimes that's from lack of competence on the part of the defense. This is personal to me as of last November 29th, and that's explained in the testimony. Let's just conclude with this. Long ago, the promise was made constitutionally that this is a government of laws, not a government of men. And it is very sad to see how little the law really matters to the people with sworn oaths to uphold it and make the law something that the rest of us can respect.
That's all.
Thank you, Mr. Barlow. Any questions from the committee? Thank you. Anybody else want to testify on this? We will close the hearing on House Bill 2141 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2343. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2343 comes to you at the request of the House Interim Judiciary Committee for the Juvenile Appeals Work Group. Allows a court-appointed attorney responsible for handling the appeal from juvenile court to the Court of Appeals to discharge his or her duties relating to the appeal by complying with the policies and procedures established by the Office of Public Defense Services.
Catherine Allward, Aylward. Oh, okay, and Jim Nass. Why don't you come together? Welcome.
We'll leave with the chair. I will go first. My name is Jim Nass. I serve as legal counsel for the Oregon Appellate Courts. House Bill 2343 is intended to allow court-appointed lawyers to discharge their duty to file notice of appeal in juvenile cases by complying with procedures established by the Office of Public Defense Services. Basically, those procedures are a interactive website. The background of this is that, as you've perhaps have already heard alluded to, there are in this world trial lawyers, and then there are appellate lawyers, and there are very few lawyers who do both. The other reality is that in juvenile court, most of the parties are represented by court-appointed counsel. What that has led to is that when a party to a juvenile case wants to appeal, their trial lawyer typically has to file a motion with the trial court asking for appointment of other counsel, and then it takes the court a while to select other counsel. Counsel gets notified, and if all works well, appellate counsel files a timely notice of appeal. What we found several years ago is that the system was starting to break down, that we were getting an unusually large number of late notices of appeal in juvenile cases, including termination of parental rights cases. So the remedy we sought in 2001 was to place a specific legal duty on trial counsel to file the notice. This caused consternation amongst the trial bar because, number one, they weren't used to doing this sort of thing, and they were concerned that having to file a notice was outside their frame of reference. They were worried about filing it late, prejudicing their clients, and so on. Nevertheless, we were unable to come up with a better system for ensuring that notices of appeal were timely filed. Moving the clock forward to 2006, the Chief Judge and the Chief Justice convened a work group to study sources of delay in juvenile cases. Amongst the members of that work group was a representative of the Office of Public Defense Services, Catherine Aylward. Catherine brought to our attention, because they have the same problem in criminal cases too, there are trial lawyers and there are appellate lawyers, and hardly the twain ever meets. And the Office of Public Defense Services had developed an interactive website that allowed trial lawyers in criminal cases conveniently to notify that office, and then a staff attorney with that office would timely file the notice. And Catherine says, why don't we do the same thing for juvenile cases? We said, go forth and do good work. And they did. The Office of Public Defense Services has established that website. It's working well. But the problem that we're solving is that the facts on the ground haven't, that the law hasn't caught up to the facts on the ground, because the statute still requires trial counsel personally to file the notice. And so what this bill will allow trial counsel to do is satisfy that duty to ensure that the notice gets filed timely by following the process established by the Office of Public Defense Services, that is, its website. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Beyer will be
conducting this momentarily.
Thank you,
Senator Beyer. Thank
you. Any questions? You already testified.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, if I could just briefly, my name is Catherine Aylward. I'm with the Office of Public Defense Services, and I'm here to testify on behalf of House Bill 2343. The primary benefit of using the online forum is that it will reduce unnecessary delays in juvenile appeals. Currently, trial counsel files the notice of appeal with the Court of Appeals and files a motion and order for appointment of counsel and transcript production with the trial court. Often the trial court then calls our office to locate an appellate attorney. When we use the online form, our office can immediately find an attorney, file both the notice of appeal and the order to appoint that attorney with the Court of Appeals, and we email a fee statement to the transcript coordinator so that transcript production can be initiated. In this way, the Court of Appeals knows from the start who appellate counsel will be. Appellate counsel may begin work immediately on the case, and the transcriptionist receives the name and address of the appellate counsel to whom a copy of the transcript must be sent. Secondary benefits include a reduction in paper flow through the trial courts, an easier method for trial counsel to commence an appeal, and more standardization of documents being filed with the Court of Appeals. This does create additional work for the Office of Public Defense Services, but the agency believes that the process can be sufficiently automated such that the work can be accomplished within existing resources.
Questions? Thank you very much. Okay. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2343. And we will open a public hearing. Should we go to 2142? I don't know if the chair wants to move or not. So, hearing. Okay. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 2142. And as soon as our counsel gets here, he can tell us about the bill. Okay, we will temporarily suspend the public hearing on House Bill 2142 and open a work session on House Bill 2343. Madam Chair.
Mr. Vice Chair, I move House Bill 2343 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick has moved House Bill 2343 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion.
Simply, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, that the U.S. Bankruptcy Court has been paperless for a couple of years now. It's an efficient, effective system, and any time a court can go paperless, yahoo. Please think that.
Well, now that Senator Walker has said that, I may have to declare a potential conflict of interest as I sell wood products that make paper, and this may impact my industry. Any objections to the
you
motion?
You sell Christmas trees. You don't need paper on a Christmas tree.
Bigger more than just Christmas trees.
And bigger trees as well. So.
Any objections to the motion? We move the bill to the floor. Hearing none, so ordered. Would you like to volunteer a carrier? As a carrier, Senator Walker, you want to carry it?
Sure.
Senator Walker is
the
carrier.
That carries the bill.
And we'll now reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2142, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Has council introduced this bill?
No.
Okay, council, take it away.
Thank you, Madam
Chair.
Senator
Beyer.
Members of the committee. House Bill 2142 relates to criminal forfeiture. Criminal forfeiture refers to the taking of property by the state due to the property's relationship with criminal activity. It's divided into two types. Proceeds, which would be an example of money a drug dealer makes, or instrumentalities, a car that a drug dealer would use to transport drugs. Presently, ORS 131.602 delineates 134 crimes for which the state may seize instrumentalities. The crime of unlawful distribution of tobacco products is not included. This omission appears to be inadvertent for two reasons. First of all, the closely related offense of unlawful distribution of cigarettes is included. And separately in Oregon statutes, the Oregon Tobacco Products Tax Act, ORS 323.630, specifically provides that tobacco product crimes are subject to the seizure of instrumentalities. House Bill 2142 corrects this omission. And incidentally, tobacco product is separate from cigarette. Tobacco product refers to chewing tobacco, cigars, or sorts of roll-your-own tobacco.
Exclusively, or does it include cigarettes?
Cigarettes are already included.
Oh, got it. Okay. Got it. All right, Cheryl Pellegrini. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cheryl Pellegrini. I am the attorney in charge of the Department of Justice Criminal Division's Organized Crime Section, and this section includes the legal and investigative staff that are assigned currently to the Multidisciplinary Tobacco Tax Compliance Task Force. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2142. I would note that I have very little to say given what your committee counsel has already explained, as he's given you, I think, a very good summary of the pertinent portions of the bill. As Mr. Stanford noted, the Tobacco Products Tax Act provides for forfeiture of instrumentalities as a remedy for violating the statutes that govern the transportation and sale of other tobacco products in Oregon. Currently, where the Act provides for forfeiture is in a provision that just sets out the civil and criminal penalties generally for violating parts of the Act. What House Bill 2142 would do is two things. Number one, it would add a reference to criminal forfeiture to the specific provision in the Tobacco Products Tax Act that talks about what constitutes a violation of the Act, and it would essentially be failing to procure the necessary permit to transport products through the state, failing to procure from the Department of Revenue a license to distribute, which means wholesale or retail, and failure to pay tax on tobacco product, other tobacco products that are sold within the state of Oregon. So it would make a specific reference in that statute to the fact that forfeiture of instrumentalities is available as a remedy for violation. In this way, it would mirror the same provision in the Cigarette Tax Act. It's not adding any greater authority. It's just dropping it down from a general provision to a specific provision so that the person reading it would realize and be on notice that forfeiture is available as a penalty. That's the first thing that House Bill 2142 does. The second part of 2142 is, as counsel said, currently the criminal forfeiture statute does not include a reference to other tobacco products. We think that it may have been an inadvertent omission given the history of the criminal forfeiture statutes. We think that LC may have just not picked it up. What happened was, going back to 2001, the 2001 Assembly enacted criminal forfeiture provisions, I believe, after Ballot Measure 3 was passed and challenged. And the criminal forfeiture provisions were enacted, I think, the District Attorneys Association were the proponents of that particular bill. When it was enacted in 2001, it was enacted with a sunset, and it was to sunset on July 31st, 2005. The thinking there was that hopefully we would have a ruling on Ballot Measure 3 by that time. In 2005, when it became apparent that we were not going to have a ruling in time on Ballot Measure 3, the Assembly at that time codified the criminal forfeiture provisions, and they're now found at 132.600, I believe, is where they start the series. And what counsel did at that time is to take the 2001 law and codify it. Other tobacco products were not included, we believe, because in 2001, the other tobacco products penalties had not yet been enacted. They were not enacted until 2003. Mm. So the cigarette tax provisions were already in place, and they appear in the 2001 Act. So we believe in that way that failure to pick up the penalties or the violations of the other Tobacco Products Tax Act were, in essence, a clerical error, a ministerial error. It does not add any greater authority to what the state already has and to what the legislature has already intended for the state to have. And it would be, I can tell you that the types of cases that we would apply this to would be cases in which we find a distributor who's bringing untaxed or non-tax paid tobacco product into the state and then further distributing it without properly reporting the tax, which is currently 60% of wholesale, to the Department of Revenue. So it's a very specific type of case that we're talking about here. And the instrumentality that we'd be looking at in most cases are what we refer to as box trucks. And they're small bobtails that are used to transport the tobacco product into the state.
So these other tobacco products, you said that their tax scheme is 60% of wholesale?
That's correct, Madam Chair. Different tax scheme than that applied to cigarettes, which is currently, I believe, $1.18 a pack.
Okay.
And different than cigars.
And do they pay into the master settlement these other products?
Madam Chair, the master settlement agreement has to do with, I think the short answer is yes, that if a cigarette manufacturer is part of the master settlement agreement mm-hmm. and that cigarette manufacturer also manufactures and sells other tobacco products, then they would be part and parcel of the master settlement agreement. Likewise, if they want to sell tobacco products, you know, I'm not as conversant with the non-participating manufacturer provisions, but I think that they would either pay into the settlement agreement or into the escrow account as a non-participating manufacturer. But
so they'd have the same requirements in that regard as...
Yes, but this is separate and distinct. This has to do with state violations for failure to follow state-based taxes or state-based laws as they relate to wholesalers and distributors of other tobacco products.
No, I understand that. I was just trying to figure out how they fit into the scheme of things. You don't hear them talked about that often. It's always about cigarettes.
Right.
And I'm a little surprised to see this before us because it was my understanding that the criminal forfeiture law really has not been used much. Is that a correct perception?
Madam Chair, I can't speak. I think that that's generally accurate. I can't speak on behalf of the district attorney's offices. I think that they're probably used in some types of cases more than others, but it's a fairly labor-intensive statutory scheme, and that may be why it's reserved, for example, for drug cases. And like I say, we would be using it within the context of this multi-agency tobacco smuggling task force that we participate in with the state police and the Department of Revenue. So we would be using it for this particular purpose.
Okay. Thank you. Questions from the committee? Senator Beyer.
Thank you. Has anyone gone back and listened to the committee records of the either 01 or the 03 sessions to make sure that this was an unintended or inadvertent omission and it wasn't purposely split out?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, no. They didn't. The statutory penalties for violation of the Tobacco Products Tax Act, I don't think they did not exist in 2001, so they would not have been a topic of conversation then. But no, we have not gone back and listen to the tapes. What we did was we looked at the 2001 statutory scheme and looked at the 2005 codification, and it appeared to be just an importation. And that and the fact that already in statute, in the tobacco products tax provisions themselves, it provides for forfeiture of criminal forfeiture of instrumentalities as a penalty for violation. So it's already in statute. It's just not in the cross-reference in the criminal forfeiture provisions. And it exists currently at ORS 323.630, subsection 7.
Okay. Other questions for the committee? Thank you. You're the only person signed up on this. Is there any opposition that you know of to this?
Madam Chair, we haven't heard from anybody. We made the District Attorneys Association aware of this, and they were generally supportive of it. As I said, we're generally the agency that pursues these sorts of violations. So.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any other questions, comments? Thank you.
Thank you.
We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2142. And, Senator Byer, what do you think? We'll open a work session on House Bill 2142. Senator Byer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House Bill 2142 to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Byer has moved House Bill 2142 to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. I will carry this. Okay, last bill. House Bill 2252, open a public hearing. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2252 relates to background checks. Generally, ORS 181.534 allows state agencies to request Oregon State Police to run criminal background checks, state or national, on various categories of persons. The agency can only require persons to provide fingerprints in connection with such background checks if there is specific statutory authorization for such a requirement. And it's my understanding that those fingerprints are required for the national background check. House Bill 2252 provides specific authorization for five agencies: the Oregon Commission for the Blind, the Oregon Department of Consumer and Business Services, the Oregon Office of Private Health Partnerships, the Oregon Real Estate Commissioner, and the Oregon Board of Radiologic Technology. House Bill 22, of those five agencies, only the Real Estate Commissioner presently has some degree of authority. House Bill 2252 expands the class of persons that the Real Estate Commissioner may require to provide fingerprints from any applicant or licensee under current law to applicants for new or renewed licenses, current or prospective agency employees, or agency contractors and volunteers. The class of affected persons, meaning those that should be required or may be required to provide fingerprints, is similar for the other four listed agencies, although the list of potentially affected persons for the Department of Consumer and Business Services is more comprehensive.
Okay, thank you. We have signed up Salvador with the last name that I'm sure you'll tell us. Welcome. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Salvador Jerenas, Chief Human Resources Officer with the Department of Consumer Business Services. I am here today to testify in support of House Bill 2252. House Bill 2252 would grant the authority to the agencies included in the bill to conduct nationwide fingerprint-based criminal record checks through the Federal Bureau of Investigation. This bill is a part of our effort to protect Oregonians against identity theft by safeguarding personal identifiable information that we and other agencies must maintain. During the 2005 legislative session, House Bill 2157 granted many agencies the authority to conduct nationwide fingerprint background checks. DCBS was not included in the bill. DCBS is Oregon's largest business regulatory agency, and many of our employees have extensive access to personal identifiable information, cash collections, and computer systems. For example, our banks and insurance examiners have access to tax and financial information, loan records, and materials from banks, credit unions, and other financial services business they examine. These records contain sensitive personal data such as name, addresses, social security numbers, and account information. Likewise, our Workers' Compensation Division maintains names, addresses, social security numbers, and other sensitive information on approximately 800,000 injured workers. Our Building Codes Division licenses approximately 42,000 electricians, plumbers, and others in the construction industry, and collects similar personal identifiable information. Recently, we have been involved with a working group that is developing legislation to address identity theft. Through this process, we have come to realize the potential risk associated with misuse of the considerable sensitive information to which we have access. We have an obligation to safeguard this information, and Oregonians have the right to know that the information is safe with us. We believe that having the ability to conduct these nationwide fingerprint background checks is an integral part of protecting personal information, cash collections, and information systems. We currently have the authority through the law enforcement data system to check the Oregon criminal records of our applicants. The limitation of this approach is in that with the mobility of today's workforce, we do have employees and applicants for employment who have lived in other states. And the LED system captures mainly Oregon-based information. So being able to conduct nationwide fingerprint background checks on positions in the agency and have this type of broad access to personal identifiable information will help us protect Oregonians from identity theft. House Bill 2252 will also allow the Department of Consumer Business Services the authority to conduct these checks on persons who are applying for license as an insurance consultant, insurance adjuster, insurance agents, life settlement providers, life settlement brokers. These licensees have a fiduciary relationship with their customers. Federal law prohibits applicants with felony convictions from obtaining an insurance license without a waiver. We currently use the LED system to check the criminal background of these applicants, but increasing number of applicants are moving between states. And again, the LED system captures mainly Oregon-based information. In addition to the Department of Consumer Business Services, this bill would allow the Board of Radiologic Technology, Commission for the Blind, Real Estate Agency, and the Office of Private Health Partnerships to conduct nationwide fingerprint-based criminal record checks through the FBI. This authority would enable the screening access to tax and financial information, loan records, and materials from banks, credit unions, and other financial services business they examined. These records contain sensitive personal data such as name, addresses, social security numbers, and account information. Likewise, our Workers' Compensation Division maintains names, addresses, social security numbers, and other sensitive information on approximately 800,000 injured workers. Our Building Codes Division licenses approximately 42,000 electricians, plumbers, and others in the construction industry, and collects similar personal identifiable information. Recently, we have been involved with a working group that is developing legislation to address identity theft. Through this process, we have come to realize the potential risk associated with misuse of the considerable sensitive information to which we have access. We have an obligation to safeguard this information, and Oregonians have the right to know that the information is safe with us. We believe that having the ability to conduct these nationwide fingerprint background checks is an integral part of protecting personal information, cash collections, and information systems. We currently have the authority through the law enforcement data system to check the Oregon criminal records of our applicants. The limitation of this approach is in that with the mobility of today's workforce, we do have employees and applicants for employment who have lived in other states. And the LED system captures mainly Oregon-based information. So being able to conduct nationwide fingerprint background checks on positions in the agency and have this type of broad access to personal identifiable information will help us protect Oregonians from identity theft. House Bill 2252 will also allow the Department of Consumer Business Services the authority to conduct these checks on persons who are applying for license as an insurance consultant, insurance adjuster, insurance agents, life settlement providers, life settlement brokers. These licensees have a fiduciary relationship with their customers. Federal law prohibits applicants with felony convictions from obtaining an insurance license without a waiver. We currently use the LED system to check the criminal background of these applicants, but increasing number of applicants are moving between states. And again, the LED system captures mainly Oregon-based information. In addition to the Department of Consumer Business Services, this bill would allow the Board of Radiologic Technology, Commission for the Blind, Real Estate Agency, and the Office of Private Health Partnerships to conduct nationwide fingerprint-based criminal record checks through the FBI. This authority would enable the screening of specified persons who are employed by or applying for employment with the agency, or those that provide services or seek to provide services, such as contractors, vendors, or volunteers. This bill will also allow the Board of Radiologic Technology to conduct these checks for persons applying for or renewing for a license, as well as individuals under investigation. Although the specific issues for each agency may differ somewhat, the other agencies included in the bill face circumstances similar to DCBS. Most of the each of the agencies included in this bill are present and available to answer any questions. Existing law, ORS 181534, will require us to establish comprehensive rules that will prescribe the process in which these background checks will be conducted. These rules will be done in consultation with Oregon State Police. Some of the procedures then will be aligned in these rules will be the establishing of job functions subject to these checks, list of the crimes that may disqualify a subject individual, the fitness determination procedures, or the nexus between the job functions and the crimes, the notification and appeal process available to the subject individual, and the safeguards necessary to assure that the records are destroyed once they're no longer needed. There are a few other agencies that have identified the need to have similar authority. We will be proposing the appropriate amendments to include the following agencies: the Oregon Board of Accountancy, the Oregon State Board of Geologists Examiners, the Oregon State Landscape Architect Board, and the Housing and Community Services Department. In addition, in our amendment, we will be proposing some minor wording changes and a narrowing of criteria for authorizing background checks for one agency in the original bill. These changes were made to address concerns raised by ACLU. House Bill 2252 passed the House unanimously on February 8. I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have, and again, we ask for your support of House Bill 2252.
Thank you. This seems very broad and comprehensive, looking to be even more broad and comprehensive. You said that you had some amendments to narrow it. Can you tell us a little bit about how you're going to narrow it?
Yes. On our bill, we describe the functions that will be subject to this authority. And in a couple of meetings we have with SLU, they pointed out then the same concern, then we were taking a very broad approach. So we have identified the functions in our Department of Consumer Business Services, then have direct access to the information we want to protect. And in our amendments, will limit that scope.
Limit the scope to what?
Of what we are of the functions that we're checking. So,
I mean, for example, would it be financial information?
Yeah, we have We have identified in our bill, I apologize, Madam Chair, we have identified payroll functions, financial and insurance information, access to employees with the social security numbers, dates of birth, driver license, personal financial information, medical information, among other things. Access to information technology, I don't know if that answers your question, Madam Chair.
That's already in the bill. I was more or less asking what you were doing in the amendment to narrow it.
Yes. Well, one of the concerns raised it was in one of our in a section we're requesting a certain authority. We were leaving it wide open for interpretation. For the agency, and we changed some of the wording. In addition, in the development of the rules requiring the 181.534, we will be creating a detailed description of all the job functions and how and the crimes there will be listed in the nexus between the job and those crimes. So,
do you have other questions from the committee?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Senator Barr.
Thank you. First, this bill is permissive, correct? It doesn't require these agencies to do it, but allows them to do it?
I cannot hear you. I didn't hear you, Madam Chair. Senator Barr.
The bill is permissive. It allows the agencies to do it. It doesn't require they do it. Is that
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, that is correct.
Okay. I see the bill has a emergency clause. So if this bill was to pass and get signed by the government, would take effect immediately, therefore affecting the budgets of these agencies and the state police in the current biennia. Is that something you intended, or would you prefer the bill would have an effective date of July 1st, 07, so that it would not affect the current budgets?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, our intentions are to enact it immediately. As soon as if we get the authority, then we would implement it right away. Most of the agencies, all the agencies, including the bill, have stated there will be no financial impact in the agencies. I understand then OSP will have some impact. There will be an impact, and there is they have submitted the financial impact statement, and I understand it has been referred to Ways and Means at this point.
Well, but as I read this, they would also charge a fee for it, which they still have to go to Ways and Means, but the way I read this, do you have this in front of you?
I do, Madam Chair. I was going to get to that as to who pays the fees. Is it the agency, or is it the person seeking the job, or in the case of the insurance agents, is it the insurance agents that are being background checked?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, with regards to employment, we would be paying the agencies. Requesting the authority would be paying for the fees than Oregon State Police charges for. With regards to the insurance agents, people seeking those licenses would be and are currently paying for those fees. So that wouldn't change for them.
So in the case of the state, it'd be in one pocket or out of one pocket and into another. It sounds
going
like
going into the state police budget. Yeah. I guess one last question, two questions. When you came and talked to the office, I wasn't aware that you were going to ask for an expansion for the Oregon State Board of Geologists, Examiners, and the Oregon State Landscape Architects Board. I'm curious to know why those agencies would need this ability. I mean, it doesn't seem like those groups would have sensitive information on.
I believe Susanna Knight from those boards is present, and she can answer. Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, I apologize, sir. And she may be able to answer more specifically what they're seeking the authority. Our understanding is, and they have access to person identifiable information, and that's what they're seeking the authority to do these checks.
Okay, and one final question, Madam Chair, to follow up on your question. You say in your testimony that one agency, you're looking to narrow the criteria for one agency, but you didn't tell us which one agency you wanted to narrow the criteria for.
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer is a real estate agency, is the one they're seeking to narrow their authority requested.
Okay, this might be you done, Senator Beyer.
Thank you.
This might be a good segue to Andrea Meyer. Welcome.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. Last session, there was a huge bill, 2157. I think you didn't see it on this side because by the time it got over here, it may have gone to rules. This was a long effort to expand almost everyone under the sun to be included under this, and we are continually surprised at fact that some agencies weren't included. Historically, we are quite concerned about requiring FBI fingerprint background checks on people. It sort of presumes that you must prove that you're innocent. In addition, it provides to the FBI fingerprints on people who are innocent, and right now, because they no longer use the card, they scan them and send them through the computer system. Although the FBI assures us that they aren't keeping these, we have a history with our FBI in this country where they do retain documents on people who are engaged in lawful activity. Indeed, since 9/11, the FBI continues to collect documents on the ACLU, over 1,100 pages. So we're always very concerned when this happens. We believe as a principle that the purpose of the criminal justice system is in part to encourage reformation of criminals, especially those who commit offenses when they are young. And we are concerned at the increasing use of background checks to discriminate against those individuals. Therefore, we've urged, and we can talk about that in a minute, somewhat in this bill and in 2157 from last session, that there be a nexus between the specific job and occupations and the types of criminal offenses that might act as a bar to employment. In addition, one of the protections last session that will be, House Bill 2252 will go into the structure that was set up last session. So even though it looks like it's a standalone, some of the safeguards that we will be talking about are not on the face of this because they're in other parts of the provision of this longer piece of law and are there, and this will connect to that. So there is the due process opportunity now for someone to get a hold of their own criminal history and to be able to challenge if there's an inaccuracy. That safeguard is in there. And then protecting broad dissemination of these bills. I want to lay out at least three specific concerns that we have in general about this, not necessarily specific to House Bill 2252. But the individuals being set forth this session and undoubtedly next session as well as last session continues to grow immensely. And we are concerned about the limiting language that you see in this bill, that it always be used, restricting the number of persons who are subjected to this. You know, 2 years ago we asked for a better understanding of the actual numbers. How many people are going to be affected? And to the agency's credit here, they did calculate some of the numbers when they came forward and met with me at the beginning of the session. But we still don't know, and indeed the rulemaking that all these agencies are required to go under before they do it to determine what crimes and what specific occupations under this formula has yet to be completed as far as I know. Finally, because of the primary safeguard on this is Oregon State Police and the LEDs system and authorizing the use of terminals. And their check on this is their audit system to ensure that, you know, the increasing number of people who have access to the audit, to the LEDS terminal and to obtain this kind of information is carefully monitored. And as their funding to do audits is, has over the years decreased, the number of folks who are doing the audits to do the safeguards are fewer. As to when we talk about limiting language, let me explain at least from our perspective what we mean by that. The department here is not seeking to do it for everyone. They have anyone employed or provide services and then the following criteria, laying out the positions to which there might be, they might come into confidential information and fiduciary responsibilities. The language that ACLU specifically had concerns about was subsection G on your first page, let's just say lines 25 through 27, and I believe this will be addressed in amendments. It says, in which person has access to personal information about employees or members of the public, including then Social Security's date of birth, driver's license numbers, medical information, personal financial information, or criminal background information. As we know, when we say including, the language that's not there but is implicitly there is not limited to. So it could include these, but it could include others. And we feel very strongly that it needs to be very narrowed, and to Social Security numbers, you know, and medical information. And so we look forward to seeing the amendments that narrow it to the types of information that a person will have access to, so that, because the argument is that if someone is engaged in, say, identity theft, that they have then access to Social Security numbers, that might not be a good match. The concerns we had with the real estate agent was that they hadn't narrowed their section sufficiently at all, simply if someone was employed or provided to seek services as a contractor. No limiting to require that this is a person who has actual day-in, day-in contact with sort of Social Security numbers or other information that can be subject to, for instance, identity theft. So that's when we look at these bills, you know, the train left the tracks in about 1991 when this first started. And the best that we can do at this point is to kind of be a safeguard in ensuring that the nexus and the other narrowing continues to happen, so that we do not become a state where everyone must get a FBI fingerprint background check before they can do anything in this state. So with that, those are our concerns, and we look forward to seeing the amendments to make sure this is narrowly tailored, consistent with the legislation passed last session. We're simply going along those lines. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Senator Cruz.
Yeah. Okay, just I'll make sure I understand. So somebody who's working for DCBS that has access to my Social Security number, driver's license number, medical information, you have concerns that that person, that they do a background check on that person?
Chair Burdick, Senator Cruz, do I have concerns which way? I mean,
well, as I'm reading, unless I'm misreading this, Section 1 defines who they would do background checks on, doesn't it? And I guess you're saying it's too broad of a language as to who. But and you reference Section G, and I would think, I'm trying to figure out what part of that.
Chair Burdick, Senator Cruz, let me help you out. You're right, Social Security numbers, yes, that's appropriate under the methodology to be included.
Right.
Where we had concerns was the language that says access to personal information, including, and then it lists those. When you have that kind of language, it's not, it doesn't just include those things listed. It could be anything else that the department then decides might be, quote, personal information about an employee. I think we know in the world of what kind of personal information can lead to identity theft. Social Security numbers.
Right.
Certainly the criminal background information, so that if there are...
So you just don't want it to be quite as open-ended. Okay, fine. I understand that.
Senator Barr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did you bring up these same issues in the House when the bill's over there?
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, yes, I've talked in general about our concerns about the issue and these concerns, and we decided, and it's on the record, that the chair of that committee felt that the timing of getting the amendments back would sufficiently hold up the bill, that we were happy to agree to let it go over here with the amendments coming to fix it. Okay. So we, ACLU, agreed to that in trusted that that would be honored in terms of, and the agency, I think they've got those amendments, they just haven't gotten out yet. So they are honoring their commitment to work out these changes with us, and we appreciate that and hope this committee will in turn accept those as consistent with what was heard and decided over on the House side.
Madam Chair, the House did that with several bills.
Yes, well, we don't let ours go that easily.
No, we
but
don't.
To each his own. Okay, what I'd like you to do is continue to work on narrowing it. And also, I want an explanation, I think others on this committee do too, is on some of these agencies. Do all the agencies here really have to be part of this scheme? And a couple of them specifically come to mind. But so we're going to be asking hard questions about which agencies and which scope, and Ms. Meyer is correct. The including language opens it up to everything in the kitchen sink. So make it more specific, narrow it down, make sure that all the safeguards are in place, and we'll bring back some amendments.
Chair Burdick, may I just respond? I just want to clarify. I actually think the agency may have just picked up language that I may have missed or others may have missed last session, and I believe this may be in the major bill, and maybe we can fix the including to language that probably appears from the model which they took it. So the agency wasn't doing anything inconsistent with what I think they looked at the House Bill 2157. So maybe we could try to fix that too and get rid of that including language there.
Madam Chair, and our amendment has fixed the including language.
Okay, appreciate that. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just you may want to note on the fiscal statement that if we include enough agencies, we'll have a funding source for state police because they seem to be making quite a good money on this.
Out of one pocket into another.
Just the bill is drafted now, they make $150,000 profit.
That's dedicated funding, too.
Yeah, so we add a few more agencies, we've got a dedicated
all right
to patrol.
Okay.
We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2252, and this committee will be in recess pending a call of the chair. Senate Judiciary Committee, and open a work session for purpose of measure introduction. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move LC 142 get introduced as a committee bill.
Senator Beyer has moved LC 142 be introduced as a committee bill. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senate Judiciary is now adjourned. Thank you, guys.
At Judiciary Committee, Monday, February 26, 2007, at 1 p.m., Hearing Room 343.
Ready to order. We have some late-breaking developments, and we have decided to pull Senate Bill 555 from today's agenda for further consideration, and we will proceed with the rest of our agenda today. So those of you who are... Oh, my gosh, half the room is going. Okay, I was warned that would happen. Okay, we will start out today with a work session for possible measure introduction. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move that we introduce, as committee bills, LC 1054, LC 2233, LC 2256, LC 2257, LC 2503,
sorry,
LC 2608, LC 2662, LC 2675, LC 2953.
LC 3006, LC 3020, LC 3156, LC 3289, LC 3491, LC 3492, LC 3493, LC 3505. And LC 3629. Those are all that I have in my staff.
Okay. Would you?
Nope, never mind. I have one more. LC 3641 and LC 3680. Sorry about that.
Okay. Senator Beyer has moved that the aforementioned LC drafts be introduced as Judiciary Committee bills. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Thank you. This is a big stack of bills. For those in the audience, this is a our bill filing deadline, and the Judiciary Committee has always followed a bipartisan tradition of introducing bills regardless of whether the individual members support them, and that's been a tradition of this committee, and that's the spirit in which we introduced this stack of bills today. So we will now close the work session, or should we recess the work? Close the work session, it can be reopened, and open a public hearing on House Bill 2121. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2121A comes to you from the Department of Justice, allows an agency to give notice of rulemaking by reference to a website unless the person entitled to notice requests a paper copy at the time of mailing, allows agency to change incorrect reference to other rules or to correct addresses and telephone numbers without having to give notice of proposed change to the rule.
Okay, we have signed up on this bill, Kyle Martin from the Department of Justice. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Kyle Martin. I'm the attorney in charge for the business activities section of the Department of Justice, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2121 as amended. Basically, this bill is a regulatory streamlining in regards to the rulemaking process. Agencies right now must give notice of proposed rules by publication in the Secretary of State's bulletin and by email or by mail to interested persons and to some legislators. This bill would permit that process to also include notification through a website address, which could be sent out on a postcard to those individuals. Secondly, this bill would allow technical changes for agencies. Right now, agencies can correct spelling, grammar, an agency name, or statutory references without giving formal notice. They simply need to file those corrections with the Secretary of State's office, which then publishes them. This bill would expand that and allow technical corrections for agencies for rules and to change addresses and telephone numbers. I don't really have anything further at this time. If there are questions that I could answer.
What do you mean by technical changes? You're expanding the authority to include technical changes. How would you characterize that?
In regards to this bill, excuse me, Madam Chair, in regards to this bill, it would allow changes to the subsection in ORS, which right now is under 183.335, subsection.
What page of the bill are you on?
I'm on page 4, Madam Chair. And it amends subsection 7D to allow a rule in addition to a statutory reference. So, for example, if a bill is filed with the Secretary of State and there's an inadvertent clerical error, for example, of referencing the incorrect statute, this bill also would enlarge the capability to allow that change to occur if it was to a rule rather than a statute.
That's as far as the technical authority expands.
That's the first part, Madam Chair. The second part is allowing to correct addresses or telephone numbers that are referred to in the rules. For example, if a state moves its office, right, the agency wouldn't have to go through the formal rulemaking process to change those references.
Okay. And then you're the only person signed up, but I understand that there's an amendment that has been proposed to this bill.
Madam Chair, the amendment is part of the legislation that's before you today. It's House Bill 2121A, and the amendment was done to actually leave in a section that the original bill had proposed to be deleted.
I appreciate that. I actually had confused this with another bill that's coming up, so thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Senator Bayh.
On the rule notice by website, would this still require the agency to notify interested people somehow by mail, but rather than mail the whole packet of rules, just tell them to go to the website? Is that what I heard you say, to see what was actually being proposed? Or is this just saying they don't have to mail anything anymore?
Madam Chair, Senator Bayh, this would still require notification by either email or mail, but the difference is that here you could refer to the website where the actual notice and the rule is located versus sending all that paperwork along.
Follow up on that point, if it's by email, would there be some kind of provision, some response required? Because if someone gets a letter at their house, you can be pretty sure that they've received it. But email sometimes gets caught in spam filters and sometimes just gets lost in the ether. Is there a response required?
Madam Chair, no, there is not, from the standpoint that the law currently allows for notification by email. Mm-hmm. And there is no provision in there that requires any sort of proof of receipt, if what you're asking. So it does not add that, no.
That doesn't change existing law in that regard.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bayh.
Thank you. How do you decide if a person gets notified in a regular mail or email now?
Madam Chair, Senator Bayh, I think that's an agency decision, and I can't speak to how agencies make that decision. There is a provision in the law that requires that if the person requests notice by mail, that they would get that, and this does not change that. It still leaves in the provision that if a person requests a copy to be sent to them by mail, that would still need to be done.
Madam Chair.
Are you done? Wait a second. Are you done?
Well, I guess I'd just still like to know if a citizen or someone out there wants, I mean, does the action on the citizen to get notified by mail, or is the action on the citizen to get notified by email? Which is the default system under statute?
Madam Chair, Senator Bayh, I'm not sure there is necessarily a default system. The law currently provides that it can be given by either mail or electronic mail.
It'd be interesting to find out if there's a, you know, on the request form, if there's a preference. I mean, if they ask for your address and your email, find out which they would do. We have somebody in the audience who looks like she can respond. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Christine Shute. I'm the attorney in charge of the Government Services and Education section of the Department of Justice, and I'm primarily responsible for the Department of Justice's organized response on administrative law issues. And so I can tell you that in most agencies, the way people get notice of pending rulemakings is a person either is on a rule that the agency has adopted that says we will notify these people, or they send in their name and address to the agency saying I would like to be notified, and at that point they either will give the agency their mailing address, their street address, or they will choose to give the agency their email address, or sometimes both. And so the person who's asking to be placed on the list actually controls where the agency sends its mail or sends its notice by choosing to give either an email address or a street address, and in some cases both. Frequently, agencies find that they get some bounce back on some of those notices when they're sent by email. I mean, people tend to change their internet service providers maybe more frequently than they move street addresses. And so what agencies have been doing to when they update those notices is sending a notice out to everybody who's on the mailing list saying, would you like to have your address updated? And if you would, would you like to get it by email or by street address and where? And so people have an opportunity to make that choice. And, in fact, they have an opportunity to require the agency always to send them the whole package, U.S. mail, so they don't have to take the extra hassle of printing things out if that's their choice.
So if they put their email address and their address on the form, then they send it in both methods?
Madam Chair, some agencies do. Now, they're not required to do that by the law. They're not required to do, but since it's no extra hassle to send an email address to three people and it is to send to two people, many agencies choose to send to every email address they have and also to send to every street address they have. So if you give them both, I know, for example, in our department, if we have both an email address and a street address, we'll send it to both. Now, as I said, there's no requirement in the statute to do that. Mm-hmm. The agency can make a choice, one or the other. Okay. It's just like if you moved and didn't give a forwarding address and the letter came back, we wouldn't know where to send it. Same thing for email address.
Well, if you're sending emails to a lot of different people, you must have a lot of trouble with spam filters filtering you out.
Madam Chairman, I'm not aware of any that we've had. I can imagine that there might be some agencies who have a lot bigger mailing list than we do, for example. They may have some issues around that.
Okay. All right. More?
No.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question here is if a person's already on the list requesting notice, would this mean that I guess my question is the agency going to inform the person that they have a choice? Because the way it sounds here, they have to do something affirmative to continue to get the paper rule rather than just get a card saying it's on a website.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I would anticipate that agencies would take steps to do that, to inform people that this is an option, and if they want to remain on the mailing list and receive it, you know, a paper copy, that they would do that. Does this change require that? No. The only requirement would be is if they indicated that they wanted to receive it by mail and wanted to receive a paper copy, the agency would have to continue to do that.
Senator Walker, did you have a question?
Yes, Madam Chair. In response to your concerns about the email, last session I sponsored a bill that the governor signed after we passed it that says that you cannot cancel your insurance, your car insurance or your homeowner's insurance by email. Congress had passed the Uniform Electronic Transaction Act that allowed states to allow people to do business by email, but they said you could still cancel health insurance and or car insurance and homeowner's insurance, which was, I thought, outrageous because your home could burn down and you find out you had no insurance. This, to me, doesn't rise to that. And so we passed a bill that says that you have to send the email out, return receipt requested. And if you don't receive that return receipt back, then you get a postal mailing. This, to me, doesn't rise to that level. That you would necessitate that a state agency send back a return receipt, because then that means your email system is going to get inundated with the bounce back that, yeah, I've received it. And I think that in this bill here right now, it says on line 29 on page 2 that notice of an intended action may be given by regular mail or by electronic mail, that perhaps you can say if requested by electronic mail so that it gives a person that option. But I know that's what you do now because we get inundated with these notices as legislators. And I made the option on several of these not to get these paper notices because they simply go in the recycle bin and I don't need to have the state sending that out. So I think that's if people make that choice to receive it by electronic mail,
then I guess they'll just have to make sure that they get the information.
Madam Chair, but I think the way this is worded, the people don't get to make the choice to receive by electronic mail. The people have to make a choice to get it by paper mail, and the agency gets to make a choice to give it to them by electronic mail, unless they make the request for paper. Now, it seems backwards to me. It seems to me that we should be making the official mail the default system unless the people request otherwise.
Senator Barr, are you talking about the notification or the big stack of paper?
Well, it's the notification of the big stack of paper. I mean, it's the big stack of paper that the agency is saying the first they're going to do it with a postcard and go to the web page unless a citizen makes an affirmative request. And that seems backwards to me because as much as people may want to go paperless, our legal system is still with paper.
Well, that was, Madam Chair, that's why I suggested perhaps we could put something in the bill here that says, by regular mail or by electronic mail, depending on how the...
If so requested,
yeah. So that then it would be the citizen's choice about how they want to be notified, not the agency's choice. The agency still has the flexibility to do it by email, but it's the citizen who says, no, I don't want it by email. I get too much in my email. Or, no, I don't want it by postal mail.
Yeah, that's what it seems like. It seems like this puts the onus on the citizen to make a choice instead of the other way around.
Right. So basically, if we put something in here that notifying... not sending the whole big stack of paper, but notifying someone that the big stack of paper is there by mail would be the default, unless the...
This is saying we're going to notify you by mail that the big stack of paper is there.
Right.
Unless you say you want the big stack of paper. Isn't that what this says?
Right, you're right. But I think that we're talking about two things. We're talking about the notification, and then we're also talking about delivering the option of delivering the big mm-hmm. stack of paper. And the notification can go out by email if the person wants it that way. Is that correct?
Madam Chairman, we're not even going to have somebody's email address, frankly, unless they give it to us.
Right.
So
yeah.
If by the time they've given us their email address, we're taking that as they want their notification by email.
Yeah. But do you have a box on it that says, because I've gotten these little cards from agencies, mm-hmm. and I am in their eternal debt for not having the big stick of paper, knowing where I can find it. If I want it, but not, and knowing that I can order it, knowing I can get it online, but not having it clutter up my house in mile-high stacks. So what you're talking about is if you're talking about the notification, if someone gives their email address and their street address, if you notify everybody by mail, I think, wasn't that the crux of your question, that everybody gets notified by mail unless they say they want to be notified by email? Wasn't that where you were going with this?
Well, I think it's getting beyond the notice because it seems to it because it's, that's already the law. It sounds to me like that on the notice, but on the actual stack of that stack of rules, this is saying we're going to discontinue sending that out mm-hmm. unless you tell us you still want it, and that's not just the notice. That's the actual document, the actual
right.
rules. No. It seems to me like that should be the other way around, that the agency should say, if you would like to receive this rather than, just a postcard telling you where to find this, we'll still, to me, the paper copies are still the official copies, and mm-hmm. and that's what the agency should be doing in notice, not as the default, not the website as the default.
Okay, well, that's definitely not... As I understand it, this bill is to change the default position and give people the option to get the paper copies, but to have it as a default. And I know that the purpose of that is to reduce paper use.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
And postage and everything else.
Madam Chair,
Senator Cruz.
What this does is allow the agency, rather than send out the paper, the big stack of paper, just to send out a notice saying the information's available on our website. That's what it does. I guess in your concerns is the fact that somebody who's currently getting the big stack of paper is going to say, okay, this is what I get now, without knowing necessarily that they still have the option of receiving the big stack of paper. So I think there needs to be something. I mean, the affirmative action a person has to take at this point is to get back to the agency and say, no, I want the big stack of paper, and they can still get it. And I'm thinking that the big stack of paper is what they have initially requested, and they should have the option of no longer receiving it, but the big stack should still be the default position.
So, and that's where it seems to me like the status quo should be the default.
Okay.
But the web-based rules could be another option that they could have.
Okay. So when you notify people about where to find this stuff on the website, in that notification, is there a toll-free number or something that they can call if they want the full information?
Madam Chairman, there could be, but this does not require that. But there could be. I mean, the agency could send out a little postcard that says, you may go to this website to access all of our rulemaking, and currently we're making rules on this one, and this one. And, oh, by the way, if you want the big stack of paper, call us at such and such a phone number. Could do that. This doesn't require it.
That might be a middle ground. Council.
And Chairman of the Committee, if I could ask just a couple of questions. One to Ms. Shute. I take it if you have someone's email address, you do not necessarily have their mailing address. So,
Madam Chairman, Mr. Taylor, that's right.
So if you had only their email address, you'd be unable to send them a written copy of the regulations without sending them an email address asking for their mailing address. Is that correct?
Madam Chairman, Mr. Taylor, yes, that is right.
Thanks.
There are some agencies who have many, many, many email addresses, and some agencies that have almost exclusively snail mail addresses. So it's just every set of those circumstances you can imagine probably exists at some agency somewhere.
Madam Chair, that gets back to my point that I think it's the choice of the citizen. And so if they've made the choice to get it by email, then you should be able to send the documents, any kind of notification, right, by email. But the default should be postal mail. Sometimes people... I know. I filed my partnership tax return this weekend and had to send in some 1099 in a transmittal form. And the Internal Revenue Service wanted my fax number and my email. I wouldn't give it to them because I didn't want them to have it, though they could easily find it, I'm sure. They're like the FBI. But I just felt like they shouldn't have that information about me, and they have my postal mail address, and that's all I'm going to give them. Some people, however, would give them all of it, thinking, well, they're asking for it all, so I'll give it all. Well, then there's no box to check as to which preference I would like to receive notification from you, the Internal Revenue Service. And what if they start communicating with you by email and you haven't given them permission to do that? I think that's one of the points that we're trying to get at here, is just if they haven't given you permission to do it that way, then you have to do it by regular mail, simply because it can get lost in email.
Council.
I'm Chair, members of the committee. Mr. Martin, if I could ask you a question. Going to page 2, lines 28 through 30, it says, unless a person entitled to notice requests copies be provided at the time of mailing. Now, does that mean, for example, if I have requested to receive notice of proposed rulemaking by mail, that you would then send me a copy of the proposed rules by mail?
Madam Chair, Mr. Taylor, that is correct.
And if I had requested to receive notice by email, you would send me copies of the proposed rules by email. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Mr. Taylor, that is correct.
Thank you.
So you'd send the actual rules as an attachment, so they wouldn't have to go to the website. They'd have them there as an attachment if you did it by email. Is that correct?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
So you could send them something through the mail to tell them the website, or you could send it by email and put it as an attachment. I think what we're trying to do here is make sure everybody gets what they need and what they want.
and reduce paper.
I guess, Madam Chair, I appreciate the need, the want, and the requirement or desire to get achieve efficiencies for the agencies, but we have to realize that for every, on average, for every law we pass, for every statute we change, it takes 10 rules to implement it.
Mm-hmm.
And these are a lot of times more onerous things to citizens that rules are than the statutes are, or that, even for us, the rules don't come out anything looking like we envisioned. And to assume that everyone wants to go to a paperless system unless they say so, I think that's where the error is. I have no problem with going to a paperless system if they say it's okay, if a citizen says okay. But unless I'm completely wrong, I'm still reading this saying that from this point in time forward, if this bill is to pass, unless a person entitled notice requests the paper copy to be provided at the time of the mailing, they're not going to get notice. They're not going to get the whole stack. It's going to be only electronic unless the person requests it that a paper copy be provided.
Mm-hmm. Okay, do you have any thoughts on this?
No, they'll still get a mailing, but it'll just be a mailing of a notice where they could get it on the website. And I guess from my perspective, I still think that the big stack of paper should be default, and there should be something in there, because a lot of people, if they got that, would assume at that point that web access was the only option they had, because this doesn't specify that they're told anything else.
The big stack of paper should be the default.
Right.
Council.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, at least the way I'm reading it, but the way you read it is makes it legislative history, not the way I read it, but unless a person entitled to notice requests the paper copies be provided at the time of the mailing. The mailing, I read, refers back to the sentence before that, by regular mail or by electronic mail. So my assumption would be that if a person has requested by regular, they receive notice by regular mail, that they should be getting copies of the regulations by regular mail. Is that correct, Mr. Martin?
Madam Chair, Mr. Taylor, that is correct. If they are requesting copies of the notice by regular mail, that would not change.
Okay, this whole list of folks that are currently receiving the big stack of mail, does this change anything that's currently happening with them? Do they still get the big stack, or do they get the little notice?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, that could change from the standpoint they would need to request that they continue to receive paper copies.
And that's the way I read it, that it does change what they're getting unless they do something else to continue getting what they're getting.
Yeah, the citizen has to initiate to get the big stack if this was to pass. Is that?
Go ahead.
Madam Chairman, maybe one way, maybe I can suggest a way out of this conundrum, and that is that when our department puts together its instructions to agencies in our administrative law manual about how to do rulemaking, one of the things we currently have in there are some tips about how to update notices and how to get information out to people and how to give people the opportunity to choose to get electronic mail or snail mail. And one of the things we could do would be to update that information so that agencies would know that they need to provide people, if they send out a little postcard notice, they need to provide a specific mechanism whereby people can make the choice to go back to solid paper, if that makes any sense to you. In other words, we'd be preserving the flexibility for agencies to still send out what I'm thinking of as the postcard notice of the website address, but have the postcard notice contain instructions for those citizens who wanted to exercise the right that they have under this provision to go back to paper. Does that make sense? Now, obviously, what I'm suggesting wouldn't be something that would be in the bill.